is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Rick Moore, where is Rick Moore? Please report to the microphone. Rick Moore, calling Rick Moore. Thank you for tuning in, folks. 11 o'clock here on Sunday morning. Gosh, it's a beautiful way to go out in the month of May 2009. May 31st, for those of you who weren't keeping track on your calendar, here at WNRN 91.9 in Charlottesville, 95.1 in Harrisonburg. And before we get started, a big shout-out of thanks to Blue Ridge Graphics. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville, providing custom T-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and online at brgtshirts.com. All right, let's get fired up and clear our throats, preferably offline. As we get started today on national politics, we have our man Jim Sofka in the studio. Jim, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Rick. Thanks for having me back.
Well, you know, when you show up on time and you speak some sort of sensibility, we invite you back.
Well, it's what Woody Allen said, 80% of life is just showing up.
In my world, it's more like 95%. Jim is a professor of politics, adjunct faculty at the Federal Executive Institute here in Charlottesville. That means that a lot of government people, important government people, come down to Charlottesville for two-week periods to be taught national, international politics by you?
They get taught everything, Rick. It's actually most of the standard programs are a four-week program, so they're down here for a month. And they take everything in all subject areas. There's courses, and of course, the main focus is on executive training, that is making them better managers in the federal government. But it's a joy. It's wonderful to work with people who have had such varied careers and to learn as much about politics as I teach them. So it's a great place to teach and to work.
So these government people come down for a month in Charlottesville.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of programs that FEI offers, but the standard course, the one that I teach in, is a four-week-long program. People coming down from D.C. or various other federal offices throughout the country and overseas.
And for those of you who don't know, the Federal Executive Institute, or FEI, is up on the hillside across from the Bodos and the...
AT&T Lord Hardwick's, store, yeah, Lord Hardwick's, yep.
On just down the road from Barracks Road Shopping Center. And there's a gate out front for those of you who want to turn up the driveway and try and get in. I can tell you that from experience.
Yeah, that's a post 9/11, as with much in the federal government, that's the price we pay for the world we live in now, is heightened security.
All right, so Jim Sofka here in the studio, as we're going to talk about the variety of national politics. With the Obama administration and some of the Republican GOP party things that have been going on in the news for the last several months. Jim, let's just jump right into the big part, assessing the Obama administration. Oftentimes, the citizen report card comes 2 years later. So 2010, when there's the next sort of federal election with the next House of Representatives and the senators who are up for re-election. But here we are talking, it's not really even 6 months yet, I guess, since Obama took office, let's see, February, March, April, May. So 4 months, slightly more. Where do we stand overall, do you think, with the United States citizens in assessing the Obama administration?
Well, Obama, you're right. It's usually the mid-year election cycle, which would be 2010, is the referendum, whether or not you're doing a good job or not. And historically, the incumbent president's party loses a few seats in House elections in off-year elections, not all the time, but as a general rule. This year's quiet. The only two major races are our own governor's race here in Virginia and another one in New Jersey. Virginia and New Jersey are always on the same gubernatorial cycle. So there's not a great deal of electoral activity in November to get a referendum on where the public's at. Right now, Obama is enjoying strong public support. his approval ratings have come down from the stratospheric mid-80s that they were in February to something more like the more mortal low 60s, or mid-60s also, depending upon which surveys you look at. But that's pretty good for a president almost 6 months into his term. He enjoys, obviously, his party control of the House and the Senate. So structurally speaking, Obama is in a very good place. If you just looked at his poll numbers, if you look at the support that he has within his party, but there's obviously a great deal going on. This president has started his term with higher expectations on him than most previous presidents, and also a far more complex agenda to face, both domestically, economically, and internationally, in terms of both national security crises, one brewing now with North Korea and also Iran, but also the outbreak of piracy in the Gulf of Aden off of Africa. So given the fact that Obama has so much on his plate and is at the polling numbers that he's at now is quite extraordinary. Now, that, a lot can change. A week is an eternity in politics. 6 months is, a geologic time. But still, Obama's holding his own politically.
And that's right. In years past, in decades past, it's always been that two-year cycle for the next set of elections to tell the president exactly what people think of you, more beyond the polls. But we're now, as people often say, a 24/7 news country. And so to be at these numbers, are people actually happy with what President Obama is doing? Or is there so much going on, like you briefly touched on, that they're saying, well, let's drop our expectations a little bit, and he's doing okay for all the things being thrown at him?
I think that to understand Obama and why he is doing as well as he is, given the scope of his agenda, you also have to look at the end of the Bush administration. It's hard to go out with lower approval ratings than President Bush had at the end of 2008 when his administration was leaving. It was as low as any president since Richard Nixon in July and August of 74, right before he resigned over the Watergate scandal. So when Bush is therefore politically an easy act to follow because the expectations on Obama were inflated. Obama has met a lot of his campaign promises, not all. And the greatest fire, it's predictable that Obama would be facing Republican fire, and they've gone off after him, of course. But there's also some grumbling about Obama in the Democratic Party as well. Those who argue that he's a little too centrist, he's a little too accommodating to Republicans, he's not liberal enough, he should take this, very high poll numbers that he has and push for a more liberal agenda. Obama has put a brake on that, wisely so, I think, because I think that in the long term that would not work out well for him to go down that road. But the expectations curve is something that Obama has had to manage, because you're right, Rick. We live in this, what have you done for me lately culture. A day or two is considered an eternity for people. They expect results. They expect the stock market to go up and housing prices to go up automatically. Just think about it. When FDR was dealing with the Great Depression, when he took office in 1933, late 33, 34, time moved much more slowly then. Things were not as complex. The American public was hungry for change, of course, and things were worse than they are today. But yet you didn't see this pressure, the drumbeat, the 24-hour news cycle for incessant demands for the president's time and demands for rapid action. So I give Obama, high marks for being able to keep his head up high, to get his administration up and rolling, given the fact that all of these pressures are on him, not just the economic, but also those of expectation and media as well.
In terms of number of issues he's faced in this, really, it's not even 5 month period yet, is this excessive in terms of past presidents and what they've had to do? We're talking about just a quick rundown of the top items: Pakistan, Iraq, and North Korea for overseas issues for international politics, the issues of Wall Street, the money going out, the General Motors issue that's been in the news, especially in the last several days, the Supreme Court selection. Is this unusual for a president to have to, you jump in running here?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so there are some comparisons that have been made that President Bush, 43, also had a similar, accelerated term and transition because he came into office with a shorter transition time because of the Supreme Court ruling finally that approved his presidency, which didn't come until mid-December. And then, of course, you have 9/11, so that took place in September when he was inaugurated in January. But yet President Bush, and of course that occupied a great deal of space, but, he also had 9 months to get his administration in place, to build a team, to get people up and running. Obama had to enter, in January and was working on a stimulus bill within 48 hours, was already dealing with the automakers that were facing bankruptcy, inherited two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. So I would argue, looking at it from the longer perspective, Obama has had more on his plate out of the gate than any president, I would say, since arguably Roosevelt in 1933, in terms of the scope.
By the way, 979-0919, stretch out your fingers. Feel free to dial up in a few moments, 979-0919. Those of you a little further away, like possibly in the Harrisonburg 95.1 or the Lovingston 94.7, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. And as always, it's the WNRN studio for the internet message. Here with Jim Sofka from the Federal Executive Institute. You mentioned President Bush getting a late start because of the Supreme Court ruling over Al Gore, and then having certainly be argued, 9/11 being the greatest issue in decades. And then you mentioned the number of things that Obama steps forward and has to deal with immediately. But he knew about it since November. The war, he knew about many of these things through his entire effort, his campaign. He knew that if he won, those two wars would be there. And he made comments about what would happen if he was elected president. He knew since September, anyway, that the automakers were going to have problems and that money had been tossed out for them. He had known since the March before that Bear Stearns had collapsed and you could see the dominoes beginning to fall. So even though he started 48 hours into his inauguration, he'd had months and months, certainly more than the five that we've immediately been talking about, to plan for these things. So does that make it so that the expectations can be higher?
Yes and no on that. You're absolutely right. President Obama and John McCain, when he was running, had transition staffs assembled as of about June, July of last year on the idea that if obviously one of them is going to win, you need to have a program in place. And you're absolutely right that Obama knew at least the broad contours of what was going on, both economically and certainly in foreign policy. That said, though, anyone and any account that I've ever read of a presidential transition is that there is no substitute for actually being in that office. You can have as many policy ideas and programs as you want and certainly should and are expected to think about these issues before you get into office. But to actually then wake up on January 21st, the first full day in power as the president, running a government, not a campaign, in a completely different style. Some of the team members are the same, but some not. You have to staff that government. You have to understand how that government works. It's very different. And it highlights that age-old distinction in American politics to say it's one thing on the campaign trail and it's another thing to actually run or administer the state, as it were. And Obama has faced that. He's had, I think you're on the right track in terms of there's been fewer areas of disconnect between what he said in the autumn as a candidate and what he's done since January. There have been some. The national security torture debate, the release of photos, military commissions. Obama has certainly in the past month or 6 weeks at most talked differently than he did as a candidate. That, the jury's out. I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt as to why he's doing that. I think it's because as president, he has a different set of responsibilities, is gathering different information than he had on the campaign trail. So in terms of, the broad answer to your question, it's a two-headed monster in the sense that Obama certainly prepped a lot of these issues out, had a basic understanding of what he wanted to do. but there is no substitute for the actual real-world experience. I mean, that's what Thomas Jefferson had a great saying that he put later in his career. He said that 40 years of experience in a government is worth more than 2 centuries of book learning. And I think that most of his successors would heartily second that contention.
11:14 here on WNRN's Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Feel free to dial us up. Sean's out here today. Back. Thank you, Sean, for returning. Sean's here today to answer the phone and patch you through, or you can ask your question in an anonymous fashion if you'd like. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, WNRN Studio at the Internet instant message scene. Jim Sofka here. Jim, you talked about giving Obama the benefit of the doubt on some of his disconnect messages. But why? Because, and it's not some of the things where you say, this is what we're going to do. We're going to send, 10,000 troops to Afghanistan. And then you say, well, wait a minute. Now that I get all the, the top secret information that I couldn't have before, I'm going to change that plan of action. Two of the things that he's been hammered about most, to me anyway, as the citizen who does not get the top secret information, keeping quiet on gay military rights. There was a military individual, name and rank, I can't toss out there, I don't know, but one of his specialties was translation of Arabic, and certainly something that is incredibly hard to find, has been mentioned for since the start of the war, a very important skill, and he is released from the military because he's gay. And President Obama on the campaign trail says, I'm not going to let this happen. President Obama doesn't speak up and say a word about it. Obama on the campaign trail says, we're not going to hide anything. This is going to be a transparent presidency. And then he says, oh, wait a minute, those pictures are a little too gross and a little too, they may cause a little too much reaction from our foes. So we're not going to show those pictures. But you are saying let's cut him a break on that.
Yeah, I'm not going to try to sound too much like an Obama partisan here. Let me step back, because I am more of an analyst of politics. I am not by any means a political activist. But why I said give him the benefit of the doubt is that from my read, looking at it from the campaign and parsing a lot of Obama's speeches and those of his supporters, he has on most issues focused on what he said he was going to do. For example, he said on the campaign trail that Afghanistan is the central national security problem in the Middle East. Afghanistan, Pakistan, more than Iraq. He said it over and over again. So to me, it was no surprise when he called for a dramatic uptick in American forces in Afghanistan. It did to some folks who thought that Obama was going to be some form of modern pacifist, that he was going to call all of our troops home. But yet, the Obama on the campaign trail made no secret of the fact that he favored a robust action on Afghanistan and Pakistan. Now, looking at the gays in the military issue, Obama personally, yes. I mean, he said that he thinks that it's scandalous that gays are excluded from serving in the armed forces, that in the case that you highlighted, and there have been some others of very skilled, experienced individuals who leave the military as a result of their sexual orientation and failure.
They don't leave the military.
They're forced out,
and I think that that's a key, phrase.
Yeah, I was just going to get into the don't ask, don't tell issue, because what happens is that Clinton worked that out as a compromise. Let's go back to this in 93 in terms of the background. Obama, in my view, has studied the Clinton actions in 1993. President Clinton started off his administration, one of his first initiatives, along with his then Secretary of the Defense, Les Aspin, pushed for a ban on the military, forcing out anyone from the military on the basis of sexual orientation. And as you remember, that created an immediate firestorm of protest. It got an inflamed culture wars. Clinton was criticized from the right and among some in the Democratic Party, including Sam Nunn. So he finally works out this don't ask, don't tell compromise, as he called it, which is that we're not going to hound you on this issue as long as you're not open about your sexual orientation. Now, in reality, it hasn't worked that way. There are many servicemen and women who report that even though that they have been harassed for their military, for their orientation, even though they are not conspicuous, that it is not a breach of don't ask, don't tell. These stories came up on the campaign trail, and Obama said that this is something that he's not going to tolerate as president. My belief is that Obama is concerned in terms of starting his administration, especially with a lot on his plate, that this issue is simply too volatile right now. And that he doesn't, it took Clinton about 2 years of his administration early on in terms of dealing with the gays in the military. There are some scholars of the Clinton presidency have argued that it absolutely wounded him in dealing with the senior officers in the American military, and that Clinton never recovered from this. And I think that Obama's view is that this is one of those cases on which it's better to hold this for what he hopes will be a second term. Let's deal with Afghanistan and Pakistan now. He wants to get his relationship off with the military off to a very strong start. He needs their support, and then deal with this issue. So I agree. It's certainly an issue on which those who supported him on that issue should expect a little bit more action. I think Obama wants to do it. I don't see anything in Obama that would tell me that he philosophically has changed his mind. It's a question of when do you push for this? Do you do it now out of the gate the way Bill Clinton did in February, March 93, or is this something that you wait on later? And there's been a lot written on this. I mean, there's a lot of articles and studies that have been done by pollsters about the gays in the military issue and its effect on Clinton. So the Obama people, I think, are concerned about that. Now, we can talk about transparency. I don't want to filibuster this a little too much, since I've been, you know, chewing up a lot of the airtime now with my, you know, lecture on Clinton. But that's something I think that is, in my opinion, gets into, especially with the national security debate with Dick Cheney, some very potentially serious issues in terms of national security and where the debate's going to be in this country.
All right, 11:21 here on the Wake Up Call with Jim Sofka, a faculty member at the Federal Executive Institute, specialty in politics. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. The markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley, mostly clear today, beautiful day, highs 75 to 80, clear tonight, lows 55 to 60. Chillier, upper 40s in the valley tonight. Sunny tomorrow, highs 80 to 85. And Lynchburg and Richmond, just a little warmer. Right now in the valley, it's mostly cloudy across the listening area. 75 in the valley, 73 in Lynchburg, 74 in Richmond, 73 on a beautiful clear day in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
Take a moment and thank 45fix.com for their support. If you have a home improvement project, there's another way to find a contractor. It's 45fix.com. From kitchen and bathroom remodeling, house painting to decks and siding, it's 45fix.com. No obligation estimates available anytime. That's the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. And let me shout out to the Look 3 Festival of the Photograph, held again this year in downtown Charlottesville from June 11th to 13th. Put it on your calendars. Festival passes are available at look3.org or call the WNRN studio line. The Look 3 Festival coming up. Jim Sofka here as we talk about politics. Jim, we had a caller call up and say pretty much what you did. If you want to expand on it, President Obama knows things that candidate Obama does not, state secrets that affect his policy choices. But again, I go back, and I understand that. When you talk about Iraq, Afghanistan, and those sorts of things, but I'm curious, you know, what secrets could President Obama know that candidate Obama does not, in terms of the gay military question? I mean, it's one thing if you say, and I'm sure that almost every president has said, I'll never raise taxes, you know, read my lips, and then does so anyway, because once you get in there, you realize, well, maybe I shouldn't have said that. There are other things that I need to, that I didn't know or that I wasn't able to focus on. But what does President Obama know that candidate Obama did not about showing those torture photos, the transparency issue, and how that is now not so transparent?
Yeah, I don't believe that the gays in the military issue is one of state secrets. I think that is a which war do you want to fight? I mean, Chief Justice Berger had a great line when he was in the Supreme Court saying that it was serving on the court and dealing with all these issues was a lot like being married. You can't go to war every day. And I think that's what Obama feels on that. He's going to pick his battles, and he wants to try and structure his relations with the military in a way that Clinton didn't. In terms of Abu Ghraib, torture, these issues, this is a different breed of cat in terms of the state secret debate. My own analysis on this is that I don't think Obama is withholding showing those photos and getting into a long discussion of what was done to these detainees, because he now possesses, you know, the magic formula that he got into the Oval Office and he's discovered that perfect formula to convert lead into gold, and he doesn't want anybody to know it. I think it's because he wants to get past this issue, and many of his Democratic colleagues are not letting him do it. There is a strong friction between Obama and Nancy Pelosi and her lieutenants in the House. Now, publicly speaking, this is not acknowledged. Everybody's on the same team. We're all happy. But Pelosi has been leading the charge for investigations of the Bush administration, for going back and narrating and documenting acts of torture. And there are many people who agree with her on this. I mean, it's certainly a sound case that you can make that this was something that was heinous. We need to go back and look at it. Obama's position is essentially this. I think it's horrible. It's awful. It's over. I've now signed all the executive orders that forbid it in my administration. I'm going to stick to that. I don't want to waste time and political capital going back over the Bush years, because now I'm in a fight with Dick Cheney and George Bush, and I don't want to be. I need to deal with an economic crisis. I need to fight a war in Afghanistan and deal with crisis in Pakistan and North Korea. And so why then not put all this information out there? Because Obama and his team know that it's going to be incendiary. He knows that it's going to fill up tremendous amounts of the 24/7 news cycle. It's going to lead to long, protracted discussions. It's going to potentially give Cheney and Bush a vehicle to say, we did this because we knew that there was X, Y, and Z plots. And if time permits, we can talk about that in a few minutes. So what Obama's trying to do is essentially cool public emotion on this. By not showing it, by moving beyond, I put this debate behind me because he doesn't think he's going to win it.
You know, I think for many people, the expectation was that the Democrat president and the Democrat Congress were going to lead to fast and easy laws, and, you know, everything that was going to happen was going to be rubber stamped. Well, that's what he wants. That's what he gets. Here's what our citizens want, President Obama says. Then you got it. You know, we're all on the same team, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
But that hasn't been the case, and it's not just this one issue. What are some of the other issues, and why is this such a battle?
Well, I mean, you know, again, I'm shocked. The president and the Congress of the same party are fighting with each other. I mean, this happened, you know, Reagan dealt with this among congressional Republicans, even though the Democrats controlled Congress at this time. I mean, this is age old, and that's because the constituencies are different. There are several areas where, both in terms of style and substance, there is a disagreement between President Obama and more liberal members, particularly in the House. One is, of course, this issue of investigations of the Bush administration, potential war criminal cases or other legal cases that could be brought, a truth commission, all of these arguments that have come out of Congress Obama's had to deal with. But if you'll remember, the stimulus bill, which was Obama's signature issue, he came in with a mandate to get the stimulus going, took a lot longer than he thought. It bogged down in the weeds of a lot of detail. There was a lot of pork that was attached to it that slowed the process down. And Obama did not get the bill that he wanted. It actually turned out to be a little bit less than he wanted, and the money went into other areas. And
with much more pork, because that was one of the initial promises as well.
Absolutely, because he needed their support, and that gave Congress control of this operation. They had to approve the money. They were in a tremendous position to demand all kinds of benefits. Obama got into a not as public as it could have been, fortunately for Obama, but into some rather testy exchanges with members of his own party. And that's because not so much Obama and Pelosi as it is the structure of our government. And that is, even if you're of the same party, congressmen and women and senators respond to different political constituencies and different forms of political power than do presidents. And they look at different things. And for members of Congress, you're thinking always in a two-year reelection cycle. That is the fundamental issue. A senator has 6 years, so it's a different structural dynamic. The president has a lot more on his plate in terms of the expectations on him as the focal point of the government, at least as many people see it, though members of Congress, of course, dispute that. There's a lot more going on here than just the relations, the personal relations between President Obama and members of Congress, which on the whole are pretty good, but the fact that they are reporting to different political demands and political pressures. And members of Congress made it clear that they wanted to have their pound of flesh out of the stimulus bill, and they got it. So it has not been smooth sailing and all rosy for President Obama dealing with members of his own party. And it hasn't been, frankly, for presidents ever in terms of dealing with this. What surprises me as an observer of politics is that we still seem to be somewhat surprised by this. We think that the government's going to move with, you know, the head sort of gives an order and the tail will follow naturally. You know, that operates in an authoritarian structure, not in ours. We do deal with rather messy political dynamics, which I think personally is a very good thing. I would much rather see these kinds of fights of presidents and members of his own party than not. I think it's healthy for the Republic, even though it may be messy in practice.
Well, 11:31 here on the wake-up call with Jim Sofka, a professor of politics at the Federal Executive Institute here in Charlottesville. Jim, you talk about how the Democratic Party is fighting amongst itself. Well, so is the Republican Party, the GOP, over the last several months. Mm-hmm. Have had the same battle, and there's several, you know, topics here to jump into. There's who is representing the party, because it seems like Dick Cheney and some people would say Rush Limbaugh are the big voices in the party. Colin Powell recently said, wait a minute, that's not the kind of Republican I want to be, and I'm still a Republican. And then there's the fact that some people are, well, Dick Cheney, for example, someone who's no longer even in office, is the person who seems to be fighting President Obama the most. So let's start there for a minute. Let's talk about what we're talking about, the difference, the infighting in the Democrats. Let's talk about the infighting in the Republican Party.
Oh, yeah, it's much worse for the Republicans than the Democrats. The Democrats, by and large, agree. They hold power. Nobody. The first thing in politics is that if you hold power, you don't want to lose it. And so, therefore, the Democrats are only going to go but so far in fighting amongst themselves and bargaining because they have a position of power in the system. The Republicans are, you know, as you allude to, in a really tough bind right now. Yeah, it seems to be Dick Cheney and Rush Limbaugh speaking for the party. That bothers a lot of more mainstream Republicans, although they're becoming a rapidly dying breed as the party is moving further to the right and further geographically more entrenched in the South. The Republican Party, looking at a lot of its poll numbers, is looking more like a regional party right now than a national party. And for President Obama and the Democrats, this is wonderful. I mean, this the more this goes on, all the better. And he loves and will actually fan Cheney being the spokesman for the Republican Party, since Dick Cheney's personal approval ratings are somewhere between 20 and 25%, depending upon what poll you look at. Powell is much more popular, has a much broader voice of support, although his reputation suffered a great deal for his unenviable task of attempting to sell bad information to the UN Security Council in 2003 on the run-up to the war in Iraq. The Republicans right now hope to sort of begin their march to power through state houses, and Virginia's one. Bob McDonnell actually early, and of course now it's only May, so it's hard to put much value in these polls, but polls in Virginia show McDonnell ahead of any one of his three Democratic competitors. That is, in a hypothetical matchup between Deeds, McAuliffe, Moran, McDonnell wins. That could change by November. If McDonnell does win, and if you see a move, a similar move among the Republican Party, the less likely in New Jersey, this will help. It will help sort of stanch the blood loss of steady electoral defeat. But the Republicans have to make a decision as to where they're going to fight Obama. And the difference seems to be, do you fight him on the economic issue? Do you fight him on questions of tax, the economic stimulus, perhaps national security? Or do you go after the cultural issues? Do you attack, for example, his picks for the Supreme Court? Do you, especially now you're beginning to see with Judge Sotomayor, her rulings in this race and in the discrimination case, alleged reverse discrimination case out of New Haven. Do you play that angle, identity, culture, or do you go more with the economic bread and butter debate, which the Republican Party sort of built itself on since the Eisenhower years? No one sorted that out yet. There's no real consensus yet in the party as to what that's going to be, and it takes you into completely different positions. My guess is the way it's going to work out is going to be the way many of these things happen and the way parties come back from years in the wilderness. It's going to take a couple of congressional elections. It's going to be fought not against as an electoral attack on Obama in 2012, but it's going to start in 2010 by going after vulnerable Democratic congressmen. For the Republicans to test market their arguments in various districts, to go it district by district rather than focus on a national comeback and hope that that puts them into a better position to take on Obama in 2012. Or the other time-honored strategy is to do very little and wait for Obama to screw up. Wait for a mistake, wait for some kind of gaffe, a scandal, something that might tarnish his image that the Republicans can then use as an attack.
That sounds like a tennis play where you play the baseline rather than running to the net.
It's worked. It worked. The Democrats made some mileage out of it against Reagan in the late 1980s. Certainly Nixon, imploded. Nixon, if you looked at Nixon in 1972, with the greatest landslide ever to 1974, it just radically remade politics. The odds of something like that happening, or Bill Clinton came close in the late 1990s, the odds of that strategy are obviously quite slim. It's a Hail Mary pass, to use another sports metaphor with your tennis. But I think that what you're going to see is a more micro-focused Republican Party. That is, let's fight these congressional seats in 2010 and see how we do. Then reassess our national position after 2010 for the run-up to 2012.
979-0919 for your question to Jim Salko, your comment on the topic about national politics. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Jim, a caller asks, when will we see Colin Powell as a presidential candidate? And my part two of that question is, several commentators have asked whether Dick Cheney is doing this to see how he might work as a presidential candidate rather than just the evil force from the vice presidential seat as he's often portrayed.
My response to both of those is it's not going to happen on either one. Powell had his chance. He had a chance in 96 and then most notably in 2000. He probably could have come close to having the Republican nomination in 2000 if he had sought it. The concern with Powell has been, at that time, what was stated at least publicly was that his wife, Alma Powell, had tremendous concerns about him running, about him becoming a potential target, about racism, whether that was the whole story. There are other arguments that said Powell just simply didn't want it that badly. He didn't have the fire in his belly to take on a campaign. Regardless, and whether or not the election of Barack Obama as the first African-American president has changed that, we don't know. I think Powell's had his day. I think especially after his performance in 2003 with the run-up to the Iraq War, it would be disastrous. I think the best course for him would be public service. Obviously, he might serve in a future administration. He could be an advisor. There's a lot of things that Powell could and should be doing. He's a very powerful force and a thinker, especially on national security affairs, who I think the nation would benefit from his counsel. But I don't see him as presidential timber. Cheney, no way. His personal approval ratings are too low. He has made far too many controversial statements, and he's too old. He's almost 70 now. In terms of attempting to run a 2012 campaign, this is a man who's had four, I believe, heart attacks, whose health is not great. I don't see Cheney seriously thinking about running for president. What he would probably like to do is serve as the ex officio advisor to a Republican president, much in the same way that he did for George W. Bush. I think he certainly wants to, he doesn't want to fade gracefully into the sunset and take up fly fishing in his native Wyoming. But I do not see either Cheney or Powell as actual candidates in 2012.
All right, 11:39 here on the Wake Up Call with Jim Sofka as we talk about national politics. Feel free to dial up and ask your question, make your comment.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, it's reading season at The Hook. Love gone wrong, family secrets, and haunting memories. Three stories by local authors are fine fiction for the summer days ahead. UVA's new men's basketball coach, Tony Bennett, takes the interview hot seat. And the folks against the McIntyre Parkway state their case in court. The Hook, always helping out our budget with a free weekly newspaper. And let me take a moment to thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for supporting us today. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports encouraging you to discover the outdoor adventures right on your doorstep at area, state, and national parks this summer. The staff at the local Blue Ridge Mountain Sports can help you with camping supplies, maps, guides, and even suggestions for excursions. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is in the Barracks Road Shopping Center here in Charlottesville. You can be found at Wintergreen and on West Broad Street or the Chesterfield Town Center in Richmond. And I'm excited. You should be excited because our man Drew Thompson just walked in the door getting ready for Les Temps Perdue, the best of 80s and 90s alternative tunes. No Michael Jackson, no Tiffany, but you will hear Dead Kennedys, Depeche Mode, and Poe. Requests always welcome. Les Temps Perdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music and Basil. All right, 11:41 with Jim Sofka, 979-0919, 1-877 WNRN Rocks, WNRN Studio for the instant message, folks. Jim, let's talk about foreign policy and international issues, national security, because I've already got a question that I want to get to in regards to that. We talked about Dick Cheney sort of being one of the leaders for the Republican Party, at least media-wise. It wasn't that long ago that Dick Cheney spoke on the same day at almost the exact same time on the exact same issue as President Obama on national security. Why? Why would he do that? What benefit comes from that?
For Cheney to speak on, yes. It's tremendous benefit, because if you looked at the newspapers, if you picked up the next day's New York Times or Washington Post, there was Obama and Cheney side by side, a story about Obama on one side and Cheney on the other. That's wonderful for Dick Cheney and for his partisans in the Republican Party, because it sets them up as equals to Obama, and it makes their argument forceful. President Obama was not thrilled by the fact that the speech, Cheney's speech, received as much coverage as it did, and it laid out a very different worldview. What Cheney argued, in essence, was we knew stuff that torture was able to provide us with information, that trust us, we knew what we were doing, and we secured the nation by using covert methods that have enhanced our national security. And Obama's argued, essentially, no, that we cannot compromise our values. America then reduces itself and debases itself if it engages in actions such as the ones that the Bush administration partook, torture, waterboarding, other covert operations, and that there is no trade-off between national security and American values. That in a nutshell, were the two speeches. The attraction of Cheney's speech and what made it powerful is it's an age-old one in the history of the Republic. It's the trust me defense. I knew things because I was in power that the American public doesn't know, and we acted on it and secured the state. The problem is it's what social scientists like to say non-falsifiable. That is, there's no way to say it isn't true. It's like arguing that NATO has kept the peace in Europe for 60 years. That assumes that if NATO wasn't there, the Soviets would have invaded France.
But that's the issue that the Republicans have been using all along, because they've I mean, we've heard it since 2001. There have been no more national attacks since 9/11. So aren't we doing a good job at keeping you safe?
Yeah, but it's logic 101, post hoc ergo propter hoc. The argument that, you know, there hasn't been any attacks and that therefore it's because of what we've done, which we don't know unless we can actually find data and arguments to show that something would have happened, like an episode of 24. You know, we knew that there's a nuclear bomb in Manhattan, and only by torturing this guy were we able to defuse the bomb. My view on this, and my wife and I were actually just talking about this last night, it has echoes of Lyndon Johnson with the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution in 1964. Johnson always argued for arguing for expanded powers in Vietnam, that he knew best, that he had information about national security that others didn't have. And the argument I would say is that given the culture that we live in, not true. If Johnson had some kind of information that would have enhanced his political position, it would have been out by leak, perhaps not with all the covert details attached, but we would know. My inclination is the same is true of Bush and Cheney. There have been some reported attacks that were thwarted, not in any great detail. My belief is that if there was something out there that these methods clearly stopped, it would be known in one way or another. It may be that Dick Cheney believes that this helped. It may be, but a lot of people in the administration do not. By no means was the Bush administration of one mind. They changed on this and evolved. The high water mark, if you want to call it that, of torture was in late 2002-03, right after 9/11. The FBI never liked it. Their other administration officials were very concerned about this. So what Cheney's attempting to do is argue for what in his judgment would be the sort of muscular foreign policy and national security. We have to have all options on the table. And Obama is sort of being soft by backpedaling. The Obama argument is that he's as much of a realist, if not more so, than Dick Cheney. He's just as tough. He's just using different methods. And that the use of torture has actually made his life much more difficult because, and one thing we haven't gotten to yet, is this question of Guantanamo. One of Obama's biggest problems is, what do we do with some of these people? The Europeans don't want them. Governors in our country don't want them in prisons in their states. You might say that, well, why not just prosecute them through federal courts? We can't, because they were tortured, and therefore any evidence against them would be inadmissible. So this has created, the use of torture and coercive interrogation techniques has created not just a horrible moral crisis for the nation, but a legal and practical one, because it limits Obama's options in terms of what he can do with some of these folks, because they were subject to this.
Let me come back to Guantanamo in a moment, because certainly I love talking about that quandary. 979-0919, if you want to ask a question. Make a comment, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. But back to the foreign policy, the two discussions side by side almost. Doug from Richmond asks, what is Obama going to do about North Korea? Because this strength and, you know, how America shows their strength has been all in the news this week. Some people would say that the Obama administration said, you know, do what you want as long as you don't hurt anybody. And then North Korea sends off a missile 4 days later, and although they don't hurt anybody, it gets everyone else riled up.
Yeah, and they're actually moving, at least today's New York Times and Post report, that there are satellite photographs that they're moving yet another missile to a launching pad. They launched one over the Sea of Japan last month. The general view on North Korea, and this is one that has spanned both the Obama and the Bush administrations, is the way to think about the North Korean government is like a 2 or 3 year old. They are acting out, screaming, and do a lot of nasty things in order to get attention and get rewarded, and then they shut up for a while, and then they repeat the cycle until they get what they want. And therefore, to react too strongly to them only reinforces this bad behavior. And to treat them as an equal player, to give them that same standing as, say, Russia or China, is what the North Koreans want, and therefore it's best not to give it to them. My belief is that, you know, I'm not an expert in Asian politics. My main focal point in foreign policy is international law and in Europe. But from my readings on North Korea, I think that thesis is correct. There is a leadership. North Korea is gearing up for a leadership secession, because Kim Jong-il is a very ill man. He suffered a series of strokes last year. He's in poor health, And my judgment is that Tip O'Neill's line about all politics being local is as powerful in Pyongyang as it is in Philadelphia. That there is a concern in North Korea about different factions setting themselves up for a secession in that government. And that's what part of this is about. We also have to keep in mind what Obama's going to do about North Korea is he's going to absolutely have to enlist regional allies. Neither Russia nor China, to say nothing of Japan or South Korea, want to see North Korea throwing missiles around, developing a robust nuclear program, and selling it abroad. There is nobody who wants this.
But my understanding, being the qualified foreign policy expert that I am, is that China has done almost nothing to help solve the problem so far. They continue to provide all types of necessary items, whether they're military or humanitarian, to North Korea.
They provide a lot to North Korea, but the rhetoric out of Beijing has changed. And there was actually a series of articles that were done on this not too long ago. I read one in the New York Times, one in the Post, and one that was done on an online site on East Asian politics, that China is beginning to change. They realize that North Korea is a bad actor. They don't want to be too associated with that government. They are concerned about stability. This is the main Chinese concern. It's always been China's concern. They do not want to see a power vacuum in North Korea following Kim Jong-il's death or retirement. What they want to see is some kind of predictable relationship along their border, and they don't want to see that area becoming a target of great international attention, or, to say nothing, of possible military action. So the Chinese, yeah, they'll support their communist brethren, although it's quite a different breed of communists than what you see in China, up to a point. But nobody wants to see North Korea destabilize East Asia. So what Obama's going to have to do is, and President Bush knew this too, there's not a lot of daylight between the two of them. Both of them knew that America alone cannot solve that problem. It's going to be multilateral. Pressure is going to have to be put on a number of fronts. What makes this crisis a little different is the level of bellicosity coming out of North Korean rhetoric. There's been, you know, they've always threatened attacks on the South. This talk about the 1953 armistice being invalid, that's the armistice that ended the Korean War, but it's not a formal peace treaty in 1953, is disturbing. However, the North Koreans have long said that they want to have a major international negotiation for a finalized peace treaty. That's shorthand for we're going to have a conference and we're going to walk away with some cookies, fuel oil, economic investment, food supplies. My belief is the North is playing this to get attention. They're playing this to ratchet up demands, to ratchet up a crisis so that there would be a summit. The summit will yield a result which will result in tensions decreasing, but the North Koreans are going to get something. That's the way I read this. I could be wrong, but I would advise Obama to work closely, particularly with the Russians and the Chinese, on this question.
All right, national politics here and a little bit of international politics with Jim Sofka from the Federal Executive Institute here in Charlottesville. 979-0919, 1-877 WNRN Rocks. Several calls today with the anonymous folks on the other end. 1152 here. Jim, let's jump back to Guantanamo Bay. It is still an international issue because we've tried to send several of these detainees to other countries. We're afraid to send them to some countries for fear that they'll be heavily punished, possibly killed. Help me understand why an American senator or House representative will not accept someone from Guantanamo Bay into their state to be put into a maximum security prison. It's not like we're asking them to put a pedophile on the street in one of their suburbs.
It's simple politics. You're right. I mean, there are plenty of facilities in the United States that can handle these people. Maximum security prisons throughout the country have a lot of bad actors in them, people who are as violent, if not more so, at least in terms of what we know in terms of their proven record, as people in Guantanamo Bay. And there are ways to deal with this. The problem is, would you want to be up for re-election in 2010 to say that you agreed to have an international terrorist put in a prison in your state.
But that's just it. It's put in a prison in your state. It's right. Put away. I'm proud that my prison in my state, whatever you think about prisons, but I'm proud that in my state we have never had anyone escape from this prison. Our, you know, Kansas brethren work there. Look at the great job they do. No one has ever escaped. You give me that badass and put him in my state and he ain't going anywhere.
Right. If you say that about, let's say, somebody who could be, and you're exactly right, Rick, this is where perception goes far beyond reality. In reality, there are ways of managing these folks within our country. The Europeans have taken some, but the Germans just recently said, no, we have no legal claim on these people. There's no reason for us to house them and feed them and deal with the potential problems with it. We don't need to deal with this whatsoever. So Obama's has a tough sell in Europe to get people to take these prisoners. And you're right. Nobody wants to send them back to countries that might release them. But yeah, if you say to people, let's say in this state or in others, we're going to put away someone who is a 12-time capital murderer, who's a child rapist on top of that and has done all sorts of other things, they'll say, wonderful, they throw away the key, put them away. If you say that we're going to put someone from Afghanistan who may have conspired to bomb a U.S. truck in Afghanistan, it's going to be a completely different reaction. And that's because of this association of international Middle Eastern terrorism. Logic tells you very little about this. It's all emotion. And legislators are terrified of this. They are scared. They know where this is going to go, and they don't want any part of it. It's the same reason, you know, this is going to sound like a strange analogy, but the fear level's about the same as in nuclear power. Everybody talks about nuclear power being a great alternative. It's green. It's safe with modern technology. You find a senator or a congressman who says, I want to build a brand new nuclear power station in my district. Everybody plays the NIMBY defense. Not in my backyard. We need it as a nation. We need to solve this energy problem, but put the nuclear power plant somewhere else. I see the same kind of perverse logic, although I probably shouldn't even, you know, flatter it by calling it logic, in dealing with this question of Guantanamo. But Obama is in a terrible spot. He's going to close that prison. He has to close that prison, which means these folks have to be put somewhere. And you can't just release them. It's like what Jefferson said in his letter about slavery. We have the wolf by the ears. We can neither safely hold him nor safely let him go. This is the position that Obama is finding himself in. And so it's going to take salesmanship. Salesmanship abroad, salesmanship with governors, senators, and members of Congress to farm some of these people out. That's the task that Obama has. And he can sweeten it a little bit by different deals and negotiated agreements, but it's going to be difficult for him.
Jim Sofka here in the studio. This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Jim, we talked earlier in the hour about Nancy Pelosi. She seems to be the face, the other face of the Democratic Party. And we go back to what I asked earlier about the president and having a Democrat Congress being unable to get through everything as fast and easy as many would have expected before the inauguration. And this is one of those issues where he wants to close the base, but my understanding or my poor memory says that Democrats will not give him the money to do so when he would like to do so. Is that correct?
Well, it's correct because they want the plan about where these folks are going to go, and because no one really is stepping up to the plate to take these people into an American facility, it's slowing up, it's gumming up the works. Nancy Pelosi is fully behind the argument about closing Guantanamo. She was on record opposing it to begin with. The actual creation of it, and it's being sustained in the Bush administration. This isn't it's not so much a policy difference between Obama and Pelosi on this. It's again that question of where are we going to put people. But yeah, on the subject of Nancy Pelosi, it's ironic because many observers last year, as a matter of fact, I think when Pete and I were here on your show about a year ago talking about the run up to the 2008 election, all eyes were on the debate between Obama and Hillary Clinton, the concern that Hillary Clinton was going to be this potential rival or obstacle to Obama, and he sidestepped that by putting her in the administration. It's ironically Nancy Pelosi who's stepping up to really be a thorn in Obama's side. She is to his left politically. She is more eager to fight political battles and partisan battles with particularly members of the former Bush administration than Obama is. And Obama has to be careful because she wields formidable power on Capitol Hill, and he's not going to just buffalo over what she says. But she is setting herself up as the sort of, or trying to set herself up as the co-spokesman of the Democratic Party. And this is something that Obama and Obama's people are none too pleased with, because they don't want to see Nancy Pelosi as being the public face of the Democratic Party. And it's also setting up a delicate task for him in managing executive legislative relations. Again, not a tremendous policy difference, although she is more to Obama's left. It's personality and it's power base. How is this administration going to work? Is power concentrated administratively or legislatively?
All right, that does it. It's noon here at WNRN. Jim, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks, Rick. Always a pleasure.
All right. And before I turn it over to Drew Thompson, let me tell everybody, next Sunday will be one of those shows where, thanks to those folks who donated at the spring fundraiser, we'll be talking with folks from the Charlottesville Albemarle SPCA, folks from the Almost Home Pet Adoption Center in Nelson County, about a variety of pet topics, including Michael Vick and what should happen now that he's been released after his fun with the pit bulls, and several other pet topics. Here comes Drew.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday, and by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasolines, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.